Hi everyone, this is Regina, and I am here for the Guiding Lights. Cheryl, there's no, I mean, I appreciate the thanks, but there's no need to thank me. I can't think of a better use of awakening together than what you all are doing with it in this hour. So we are here again for the Guiding Lights. We haven't had the Guiding Light in 2 weeks because last week I was here with Ellie Ruzdar. So it was 2 weeks ago when we read from the Bible last. One thing I want to say before I get started with our review is that starting next week, the Guiding Light is going to be at a new time, just half an hour later. What we're doing is we're switching prayer circle and the Guiding Light. Right now, the Guiding Light starts at 2, and prayer circle starts at 3. We're changing that so that prayer circle will start at 2, and then the Guiding Light will start immediately after prayer circle at 2:30, and it will go 2:30 to 3:30. So it's just a little swap there. Also, Carrie is going to begin leading the prayer circle. So after this little open mic or round table or whatever you call it that Stephanie and Cheryl lead or facilitate, right after that, starting next week, you will have prayer circle with Carrie for 30 minutes. And then starting at 2:30, I will be here for the Guiding Lights. So 2 weeks ago, which Kathy said seems like 2 years ago. I agree. It seems like a year ago when Ellie was here. I can't believe that was only a week ago. It's amazing, isn't it? But 2 weeks ago, we were reading the story in the Bible that leads up to the resurrection of Lazarus. And today, where we begin reading, it's going to be Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. But there were some important things that we saw in this story that I'll just kind of quickly review, bring back to mind. One was that the apostles were encouraging Jesus not to go back to Jerusalem because they knew that the Pharisees and the Sanhedrin were not excited about Jesus' presence, and in fact were maybe plotting to arrest him, and they had thrown stones at him before. And the apostles were concerned about Jesus' physical safety, and they did not want him to go to Bethany where Lazarus was dead, because Bethany is really only 2 miles from Jerusalem. So it would be very, very close for the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Sanhedrin to come out and in some way persecute Jesus. So they didn't want Jesus to go. And Jesus responded with kind of a strange saying, one that you might have to contemplate. If you don't pay much attention, you might say, well, why in the world did he say that in response? But what he said was that there are 12 hours in a day. And if we walk in the daylight, we do not stumble. And if we walk in the darkness, we do stumble. What he meant by that is we just have to follow our guidance. And if we follow our guidance, then everything we're doing is perfect. We're not stumbling, is what we mean by perfect. If we don't follow our guidance, in some way it is a mistake or we are stumbling. So we don't make our decisions based on things like if we go that close to Jerusalem, Jesus, in some way you may be persecuted or arrested or even killed. That's not the basis of the decision, this potential seemingly dangerous outcome. The only basis of the decision is that it feels within like guidance to go. And if it feels within like guidance to go, then regardless of what happens, it's for the good of all. But if we avoid this in some way, if we avoid guidance, then we stumble. And so this is an opportunity for all of us to look at how we make our decisions. Are we analyzing the situation and thinking about what appears to be in our best interest and making that choice? Or are we simply checking within for that go or no go, which feels like guidance, and then just trusting it regardless of the outcome? Another thing that we saw 2 weeks ago is Martha, who is Lazarus's sister. Martha, when Jesus came near, Martha ran out to greet him and said, "Oh, my brother is dead. If you had been here, he would have lived," because she had faith that Jesus could have healed his sickness. And Jesus said, "Your brother will rise again," meaning, you know, I'm about to walk over there and raise him from the dead. But because Martha had prior religious beliefs, she was unable to hear directly what Jesus was saying. So when Jesus said, "Your brother will rise again," she said, "I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day." She only heard what she already believed to be true. And so the question for each of us then, based on that example, is how often does our learning from past experience or past study, whatever, how often does our learning get in the way of current wisdom that may be even more enlightening, that may take us further? Do we let our old learning keep us stuck? Do we judge wisdom when it comes based on whether it matches our prior learning or not? And if not, discard it. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh, in his book, The Heart of Buddha's Teachings, this is one thing he really warns against. He warns against, you know, taking what you already think is truth based on prior learning, and then when you're reading something new, judging it based on that prior learning and discounting what actually may take you deeper into truth because it sounds different. And in fact, I would say this is probably one of the reasons for Awakening Together. People are more likely to make that mistake when they are immersed in only one spiritual tradition. When you are immersed in only one spiritual tradition, you can become attached to its symbols. You can become attached to the words that it uses and the way it says things. And so when something else sounds different, you discount it because it sounds different. And in Awakening Together, we have such a mixture of symbols from different traditions that what we're really learning to do is to listen beyond the words. We're learning to hear with ears that really hear. But we still want to heed Martha's example. You know, she it was a bad example. Because she could not hear because of her prior learning, because of what she already believed. So we want to learn from her bad example and check ourselves to make sure we aren't making the same kind of mistake. So that's kind of a review of 2 weeks ago when we were looking at the Bible before. And as always, I'm going to play just a little transition song to move us from the review into the new material. This is a funny song. I might even have to explain to you because some of you are going to think this sounds very judgmental. And maybe the song's even written in a judgmental way, but, you know, I hear it with my right mind. It's a bluegrass band called the Johnson Mountain Boys. They were actually friends of mine once upon a time in my younger days. The name of this particular song is "Do You Call That Religion?" And, you know, if you listen to the words and take them very literally, then it sounds kind of like, you know, you aren't following the rules of the faith, therefore you're a hypocrite. But that's not the way I hear the song, "Do You Call That Religion?" I hear the song asking me to check myself. Am I really walking my faith, living my faith In that way, is it really my faith? I mean, I can talk a certain faith and then act from something else. And whatever I'm acting from is what I truly believe in. So whenever I listen to this song, Do You Call That Religion? What I'm really doing is reminding myself to be self-honest. So here we go. It's from some old friends of mine. Good group of guys. The Johnson Mountain Boys.
Well, the preacher in his church house all reared back in his chair. But when you tell him about his duty, he'll say that he don't care.
Do you call that religion?
Oh, no.
No. Do you call that religion?
Oh, no.
I declare, ain't that a shame?
Well, you claim that you've been converted. Well, why don't you stop telling lies? I quit drinking your beer and your whiskey and live a more different life.
Do you call that religion?
Oh, no.
Do you call that religion?
No, child, no.
Do you call that religion?
Oh, no.
I declare, ain't that a shame?
Last Sunday when the preacher was preaching, Lord, you all began to shout. But when he asked for a little collection, you had your mouth opened.
Do you call that religion?
Oh, no.
Do you call that religion?
No, child, no.
Do you call that religion?
Oh, no.
Dancer says, oh my gosh, Regina, just had a memory pop up. Ages ago, my granddad danced a jig to this bluegrass style of music. It was shocking because it was against our Church of Christ religion to dance. It was the one and only time he ever danced that jig, and it was amazing, as if he'd been a closet dancer for years when he was in his 70s. Yeah. All right, so why don't we go ahead and begin reading today. We're going to begin reading in the Bible at John chapter 11, starting with verse 38, and the name of this story is Jesus Raises Lazarus from the Dead. Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. Take away the stone, he said. But Lord, said Martha, the sister of the dead man, by this time there is a bad odor, for he has been there 4 days. Then Jesus said, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, But I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me." When he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go." Well, this teaching is a symbol. Whether it actually happened or not, it's the same symbol. It's the symbol that life doesn't die. Life doesn't die. And this is very important to us. It's very important to us to see that we are not the temporary character. At the end of this, Jesus says, "Take off the grave clothes." The grave clothes are the belief that I am Regina, or in your case, that you are fill in the blank with your name. The grave clothes are the belief that what I think is right, and that what I think is wrong, that what I think is true, and that what I think is false, that what I think is worthy, and that what I think is unworthy or shameful is unworthy and shameful. The grave clothes are what we could call the personality thinking mind, and believing that to be true. So Jesus went to where Lazarus was laying. It says he came to the tomb. But then it says that the tomb was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. Well, a cave is a symbol of a deep within. And the stone laid across its entrance is the symbol of any obstacle that keeps us from recognizing the life that is present, is what we really are, that we access by going deep within. When Jesus asked them to remove the stone, Martha objected. Her objection was, "By this time, there is a bad odor, for he has been there for 4 days." That objection is a symbol of the belief that what's in the cave, or what's deep within, is somehow dangerous, scary. It needs to be avoided. That I'm safer out here on the outside of the stone that blocks the cave. And most of us live our daily lives that way, as if what's out here is safer. It's safer to be Regina in this house, with this family, with this job, with this life, than it is to go within the cave to remove the obstacle and discover the truth of what I am. Somehow there's an idea that the truth of what I am is death. And that this thing that I think I am is life. But that's not true. You know, I have a Buddhist symbol here in my office that I just liked. I didn't really know what it represented. I just saw it and liked it and, you know, kind of commented that I liked it. And usually if I comment that I like anything, Ron buys it for me. So he bought it for me. So I have it. But just a few days ago, I was in a Tibetan store and I ran across the same statue, but this statue had with it the little story, like a little plaque on it with the little story of what the statue represents. And the statue is Buddha laying down, reclining. And it turns out that that represents Buddha on the deathbed. And that Buddha's last words were something like, I can't quote it exactly from memory, but that Buddha's last words were something like, this body and everything organic will come to an end. Therefore, spend your life seeking liberation. This body and everything organic will come to an end. Therefore, spend your life seeking liberation. Buddha's words are actually pointing to the exact opposite of what we unconsciously believe. We don't think about the fact that this body, this personality, is going to come to an end. We live as if this body, this personality, is going to live forever, as if this is who we are. We live as if being outside of the cave is safer. But what Jesus is demonstrating is that true life is inside that cave. And that we have to remove the obstacles that cover the mouth of the cave. And then, of course, we go within the cave. And it's in the cave where we are resurrected, where we find our true self. And Lazarus demonstrates this for us by being resurrected in the cave and then coming out for everyone to see. So I think that probably one wonderful thing for us to contemplate, really very deeply, if we're willing, is when Jesus says, take off the grave clothes, right? Take off the grave clothes. So what are our grave clothes? What are we most attached to that keeps us occupied with believing that we are this temporary self, which Buddha has very clearly told us is going to die? What is it that keeps us from spending our time going within the cave, going within, seeking our truth, our resurrection, eternal life? Why aren't we, no matter how dedicated we are to that purpose, why aren't we more dedicated? What are our personal obstacles? It's funny for two reasons. One, this morning in my own personal contemplation time, I spent time looking for these exact obstacles in me. And I came up with a list. And the way that I came up with the list was that I would go into meditation my purpose was to go into meditation and focus on the true self, awareness, presence, beingness, isness, whatever you want to call it. That was my purpose. But then when I was distracted from that and got caught up in some thought stream, I would look at that thought stream. And I would write that down. This is one of the things that distracts me from spending more time within, resting in the self. How do I know that? Because it just distracted me. I just now became interested in that thought stream. It just distracted me. So I wrote it down, and then I would close my eyes. I would go back into focusing on awareness and stay there for however long I stayed there. But then when I noticed that I was really distracted into a thought stream again, I would look at it and say, ah, there's something else. There's something else that distracts me. How do I know? Because it just distracted me, right? And I created a nice little list of things that distract me. Why create a nice little list of things that distract me? Well, my experience has been when I pull something into awareness, it heals. For example, when I was with Michael Langford, some of y'all may have heard this on the audio, I read to him about 10 statements that I had written down in my journal, things that kept me from meditating, thoughts that when I believe the thought, I would skip meditating that day. I read it to Michael Langford. And since I've been back, I haven't missed a single day. Something healed just in bringing that out into awareness. Without any shame, without any embarrassment, right? I didn't hide it from even Michael Langford. I just brought it into awareness. When I hear this thought and believe it, I skip meditation. When I hear this thought and believe it, I skip meditation, right? There were 10 of them, I think, something like that. And I haven't skipped a day of meditation since. So maybe being aware of the list of things that distract me in meditation, pull me out so that I'm in the thought stream instead of resting in the self, maybe, most likely, just being aware of that in a very honest way, that will heal too. I'm taking off my grave clothes. So that's one of the reasons that it's kind of funny to have this. You know, it's always funny, don't you think, when coincidences happen? Is that serendipity? Is that another good word? When coincidences happen where the same lesson is kind of being emphasized no matter where we look. So here I was this morning looking at what distracts me. And now here we have Jesus telling us to take off our grave clothes, take away those obstacles that keep us from going deep within the cave. And then, you know, the other funny little coincidence is the song that I played. Do you call that religion? Again, heard with the wrong mind. You know, that's a very maybe judgmental, albeit fun, song. But heard with the right mind, it's encouraging us to be very self-honest with ourselves. If we say that we want to awaken to the true self, and I think that most of us do say that. That's why we're here in Awakening Together, right? If we say that, then are we living that? Are we finding our obstacles? Are we actively looking for our obstacles and letting them go? Another thing that happened when I was with Michael Langford is I used a term. I said something about letting go of ego. And he said something like, that's not specific enough. That's too general for a purpose. Letting go of ego is too general. And therefore, it doesn't have enough clarity behind it. You need a more specific purpose. And the purpose that he recommended was wanting to see the ego's thousands of layers of tricks. Wow, talk about taking off your grave clothes. Wanting to see the ego's thousands of layers of tricks. Would you guys like to hear what distracted me this morning in my meditation? Let me grab my notebook. The first one was a real surprise, actually. And it is a surprise if it's something that you haven't seen so clearly before. The first thing that I noticed was distracting me. I was thinking about something that I can share that would help clarify a confusion. I was thinking about, while I'm supposed to be in meditation, just being in the self, I was thinking about something I could share that would help clarify a confusion. I realized I wanted to help others. That was an eye-opener for me. Because, you know, several years ago when I talked to Ellie Ruzdar, she told me at that time that I was not ready to awaken because I wanted to help others. And I said, that's not true. I said, you know, I may be doing what I do and it may help others, but I'm only interested in my own awakening. But if I'm only interested in my own awakening, if that's the truth, wouldn't I have just been interested in resting in the self? If I was only interested in the self, isn't that where my attention would have laid? The fact that I got lost, even for, I mean, it wasn't a long time. It was, you know, seconds. But the fact that I got lost in a thought stream that had to do with helping others said, ah, that is an obstacle. It is an obstacle because you're in meditation now. And for at least a few seconds, you were more interested in thinking about how you could help others than you were in resting in the self. So I wrote that down. That's one of the strips of cloth on my grave clothes. Let's see what else I found here. Wanting things done right. That has to do with my job. That's what this is specifically referring to. You know, wanting things done right. You know, it sounds good, wanting the sanctuary to run well, wanting us to get things posted well, wanting us to inform you, keep you well informed of what's happening, wanting us to have a better website, you know, all that kind of professional stuff. I found myself getting a little distracted, and I don't even remember what it was now, but there was some thought about getting something done and making sure that it was done right. You know, it might have been having something posted on time. Oh, I can't forget to post this or something like that. But it distracted me from resting in the self. There was enough interest in it that while I was in meditation, with my eyes closed, with the opportunity just to rest in the self, I got caught up in a little thought stream about getting something done right when it came to my job, Awakening Together. So I wrote that down. That's another part of my grave clothes, wanting something to get done right. Now, the next one that came was very interesting. I called it obligation. What came in this particular case, but I generalized it beyond this, but what came in this particular case was some kind of a thought about I needed to be careful how long I sat in meditation because I haven't worked out in a week and a half and I needed to go work out. And the funny thing is, that thought had nothing to do with me wanting to keep the body in shape. That thought had everything to do with Ron spent thousands of dollars on that gym that I have here in my house. Thousands. I probably have a $10,000 gym in my house that he bought me early this year. And I haven't used it in a week and a half. I'm obligated to use that gym, right? And so I began to look at the idea of obligation. I began to ask myself, what is obligation? What's the difference between obligation and what Michael Langford would call a necessary activity? And I realized that obligation has a hidden motive under it. Like in this case, in the case of using the gym, I would want Ron to be approving, right? He would not be approving if he spent $10,000 on a gym and I never used it. Definitely he would not be approving. And I wanted him to be approving. So I wanted to get that approval. Yeah, I do have an awesome gym. I know. I wanted to get that approval. Did I ask for the gym? You know, I may have mention something. You'd be surprised how easy it is around Ron. If you mention something, oh, it'd be kind of nice to have, the next thing you know, you have it. You don't really even have to put a lot of effort or a lot of desire into it. In fact, Jasmine and I are learning not to say things because if you just kind of mention, you know, it could just be an unimportant whim that comes off the lips and the next thing you know, you own it. So Jasmine and I are learning not to say anything. Yeah, he wants to keep his ladies happy. But we digress. Let's go back. So obligation really has a hidden motive behind it. You actually want to get something. You know, you want to not feel guilty. You want to feel approved of. You would have to look at your own obligations. Anything that feels like an obligation, you would have to look at your own obligation and ask, what do I want to get from this? But an obligation has a hidden motive. A hidden motive is a desire. Which means if I have anything that I feel obligated to do, I have a hidden desire underneath it. If I have a hidden desire underneath it, then I do not desire only the truth. I desire whatever it is that is causing me to feel obligated. In fact, I wrote, "No one obligates me but me." If I let go of all wantings but one, I can have no obligations. So let's see if there was something else on the list. It looks like the mind went into, and this distracted me from meditation, the mind went into a fantasy, just something that will never, ever, ever be true. You know, I have no idea what it was. I don't remember. But let's pretend like I was being the advisor to Donald Trump, you know, or something just crazy, right? And he's listening to me and taking my advice. And in my mind, I'm thinking about this, right? Something that would never, ever, ever, ever happen. A fantasy. A fantasy had the power to distract me from resting in the self. So I had to look at that. What would cause me to get caught up in a fantasy? And you know what I found? It's the entertainment value. There's an entertainment value. We actually like to be entertained. So then the question has to come, do I value entertainment more than truth? The desire to be entertained is another strip of cloth on my grave clothes. Another thing that I noticed, and each of these, by the way, were very brief. They weren't long things because I think I've trained my mind fairly well that I only diverge for a little bit, and then I notice I've diverged and I come back. But I still thought it was worth writing down what was causing me to lose track of my purpose during meditation. So the next thing that came was a little bit of thinking about, am I meditating right? How many of y'all ever do that? While you're meditating, think about, am I meditating right? Is my desire to meditate right more important to me than truth? So that it can actually distract me and cause me to think about it? So these were the things I wrote down. Let me just go over this little list again. And I spent, you know, I don't know how long, 2 or 3 hours doing this morning. It was a bit of time. So let's see. One was, there was a thought about helping others. Two, there was a thought about getting something done right at work. Three, there was a thought about an obligation. I got to make sure I stop in time to do this other thing, which I'm obligated to do, which, by the way, I didn't. Three, there was just a fantasy that I got lost in a little bit, a completely unreal fantasy. And then four, just a little bit of thought about, am I meditating right? Now, I noticed the fool is telling me, I think you think about it too much, but I actually think this little exercise this morning was very helpful. I think bringing into my awareness what distracts me instead of remaining unaware about what distracts me is very helpful. Because now that it's brought into my awareness, each of those things has less power to distract me than it did before. And even sharing it with you gives it even less power, because sharing it with you, I'm reviewing it and bringing it even more strongly into my awareness. Just like when I shared those 10 thoughts that keep me from meditating with Michael Langford, and then ever since then I haven't missed a single day. By bringing this stuff into my awareness, there's less power in it. It's taking off my grave clothes. So that's what Jesus is recommending here. He's asking us to take off our grave clothes. I'm going to continue reading now in the Bible. The plot to kill Jesus is what comes up next. And remember, this is why the apostles didn't want to go to Bethany, right? They were afraid for Jesus' physical safety. So here we go. The plot to kill Jesus, starting at verse 45 in chapter 11 of the book of John. Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did put their faith in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing? They asked. Here is this man performing many miraculous signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. Then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than for the whole nation to perish. He did not say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. Therefore, Jesus no longer moved about publicly among the Jews. Instead, he withdrew to a region near the desert, to a village called, I don't know the name of this, Ephraim, it's A-I-M, so it has Ephraim. Instead, he withdrew to a region near the desert, to a village called Ephraim, where he stayed with his disciples. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, many went up from the country to Jerusalem for their ceremony cleansing before the Passover. They looked for Jesus, and as they stood in the temple area, they asked one another, "What do you think? Isn't he coming to the feast at all?" But the chief priests and Pharisees had given orders that if anyone found out where Jesus was, he should report it so that they might arrest him. So for me, this was more story than anything else. I don't know that my mind came up with any enlightening thoughts that there are to share. So I'm just going to continue with the story. I'm not going to make up anything. That would be ridiculous. I have no obligation to have something enlightening to say about every single story, so we'll just move on. So now we're going to start John chapter 12, Jesus anointed at Bethany. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus arrived at Bethany where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Martha served while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. Then Mary took about a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. "Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages." He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. "Leave her alone," Jesus replied. "It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me." Meanwhile, a large crowd of Jews found out that Jesus was there and came, not only because of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well. For on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and putting their faith in him. Well, just one little biblical point. You know, this is the only book of the Bible that mentions that the woman who anointed Jesus with the expensive perfume was Mary, the sister of Lazarus. And many people have a belief that it was Mary of Magdalene. But here it says it's Mary, the sister of Lazarus. And I don't think you have to think about it very hard to understand why she might be incredibly, incredibly grateful to Jesus, in awe of Jesus. You know, I mean, Jesus raised her brother from the dead. And so when he comes back to her house to visit the next time, she is ready to honor him. This is not a hard thing to understand. So that means that we need to turn our attention to Judas. Now, John writes that Judas's true motive was that he wanted to steal the money. Maybe, maybe not. Who knows? Who knows? But one thing that each of the books of the New Testament that mention this story have in common is that Judas was very upset by this moment when Mary was anointing Jesus with this expensive perfume. Maybe he wanted to steal the money. Maybe he saw Jesus as allowing himself to be put on a pedestal. Maybe he began to question whether Jesus was sincere or just another one of many fake messiahs that they had in that day. It really doesn't matter whether Judas wanted to steal the money or whether he began to question Jesus' sincerity or whether it was something else. Regardless of what caused Judas to turn in this moment, because this was the moment of Judas's turning, regardless of the specific story in the head, the mistake that Judas made was believing his own thoughts. And that's something we're all capable of doing. So Judas is setting a very important example for us. Again, a bad example, but a very important example for us. Judas is believing his thoughts to the point that he is going to completely turn away from the voice of truth in his life, which was represented by Jesus. When we listen to the ego, even if we're listening to the ego as it talks about helping others, as it talks about getting something done right at work, as it talks about some obligation I have so I don't disappoint a family member. As it talks about, do I meditate right? Do I contemplate right? Whenever we turn our attention to the ego and we listen to it, we are literally turning away from the truth. This is what Judas is teaching us. This is what's most important for us to see here. Whenever we give attention to the ego chatter in our mind, regardless of what that chatter is, we are literally turning away from the truth. If we can just take a moment to contemplate that, take a moment to ask ourselves, what do we truly want? Do I want to be distracted from the truth? Or do I want to turn my attention toward the truth? Remember that this story that we're reading, although it appears to be about other characters, it's about us. It's about our own opportunity to awaken. And Judas is demonstrating for us how we can make a mistake and turn away from truth by believing the thoughts in our mind. Thank you, Judas. Thank you. Thank you for showing us our mistake. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to contemplate what we really want. Thank you for setting an example for us so we can see what we're doing when we believe our own thoughts. Maybe that will help us to finally lose interest in them. The next story in the Bible is the triumphal entry. The next day, the great crowd that had come for the feast heard that Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem. They took palm branches and went out to meet him, shouting, "Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the King of Israel." Jesus found a young donkey and sat upon it, as it is written, "Do not be afraid, O daughter of Zion. See, your king is coming, seated on a donkey's colt." At first, his disciples did not understand all this. Only after Jesus was glorified did they realize that these things had been written about him, and that they had done these things to him. Now the crowd that was with him when he called Lazarus from the tomb and raised him from the dead continued to spread the word. Many people, because they had heard that he had given this miraculous sign, went out to meet him. So the Pharisees said to one another, "See, this is getting us nowhere. Look how the whole world has gone after him." So what I feel to do here in our last few minutes is to focus on this prophecy. O daughter of Zion, see, your king is coming, seated on a donkey's colt. For me, the donkey's colt represents humility. It's the humility of the ego. That allows us to go within and accept the truth. Claim the truth, as Ellie would say. It's the humility of the ego. Yes, donkeys. Colt. So yeah, the child of a donkey, right? A donkey's colt. Doesn't that represent humility? How humble can you get? You can't get more humble than riding on a donkey's colt, right? You're not riding on a great big black stallion, or you're not riding on a well-decorated carriage. You're not riding on a well-decorated carriage. You're not even riding on the shoulders of people who praise you. You're riding on a donkey's colt, right? Very humble, not even a donkey, a donkey's colt. So, one thing we can do if we want to realize truth is help train our ego to be humble. Humble. One of the best definitions of humble when it comes to training the ego to be humble is letting go of the idea I'm right You see, the ego thinks I'm right about whatever it thinks. The ego thinks I'm right about whatever it thinks. And as long as the ego thinks I'm right, it believes in itself as a separate entity. So, one thought we can practice letting go of is the thought, I'm right, wherever it shows up. If we can help the ego to become humble by letting go of the thought, I'm right, we kind of take the wind out of its sails. If it's not right, if it's not right about what it is, if it's not right about itself, then, you know, it's like pulling the plug on something that's all flated up and it can just deflate completely down. So it's time for me to wrap this up. So yeah, why don't we just leave it with that suggestion of watching the mind. How often does it think it's right? And maybe just whisper kind of back to it from a gentle, non-judging place. You might not be right. Or you definitely aren't right, if we can say that. Not right. Start teaching it. Not right. Not right. And let's just bring that ego down, down, down to a very humble stature where it's not so sure that it's right about itself. Yeah, I don't know is the humble stature. Thank you, Kathy. All right, so that concludes our reading for today. And so, I'm going to put on some music and we will go into prayer circle. Just a reminder that next week prayer circle will be at 2 p.m. Eastern time from next week on. It's a schedule change and Carrie's going to start leading prayer circle. I will be here right after prayer circle from 2:30 to 3:30 for the guiding light. So just a little schedule change starting next week.